when I went to SPCK to propose this book to them, we kind of, you know, they agreed to it and stuff. And when we came to do the book, they said, oh, let's not tell people you're a math teacher. Probably. So I'm not telling you I'm a math teacher, because it puts people off. I work in a comprehensive school in South London. Well, I actually don't really work anywhere at the moment, because I'm kind of between two schools, one of which was in Putney, where we creamed off the bottom there. And I'm now going to be working in, well, it's Dulwich, really, and we're creaming off the bottom there as well. So let's just begin. I'd just like to pray first before we start. Lord, in the words of Tom York, I might be wrong. Amen. Lots of people who I call my friends have been really giving me a very hard time, because coming to Greenbelt and going to talks about people who've got books to promote is just, you know, one of those things that you try and avoid doing, but here I am doing it now. But I don't want this to be just a talk about a book. In other words, if you've heard the talk, don't bother buying the book, because that'd be silly, because none of you would buy it. I want to talk about this in sort of more general ways. And what I really want to do is to be able, through the talk and through the book, to be able to prime the pump of a discussion. The book is not a series of answers. It's really, hopefully, a series of questions and a discussion starter about stuff. So I'll say from the outset and repeat at the end that what I'd really like to happen is for people to start engaging with the ideas. And I've set up SPCK have set up a website, thecomplexchrist.com, where you can join a discussion board, share ideas, download articles, upload articles, that kind of stuff, because I want this to be a discussion. This is not about me, the expert, at all. And we've got to get away from that mentality anyway. Please do interrupt. I don't want this to be just some linear monologue. It'd be great if people do feel they want to challenge stuff. To do that, obviously try and preserve some sort of linearity for those who are listening to this on tape or whatever, but we'll try and keep it reasonably sensible. That's my niece, who lasted 5 seconds, I think. Dear, I shouldn't do that, sorry. Anyway, let's get started. I want to start, actually, on the beach. There's a very good magazine called Prospect, which I've started subscribing to, and there's an article in there about beaches, which I want to read a bit to you from, and see if you kind of recognise anything to do with Greenbelt. Beaches are places where normal rules and authority do not apply. Beaches are ordered without being controlled. There is no one in charge. They rely on mass self-organisation. They are also largely beyond the reach of corporations and the market. Shifting sand does not support billboards and branding. Beaches are a model civic space, tolerant, playful, and self-regulating. Just further on in the article, they say, as a day on the beach unfolds, everyone takes their chosen spot, adjusting minutely to where everyone else has pitched their towel or windbreak. There are no regulations, zoning restrictions, fences, or white lines to tell you where to go. Other than the odd lifeguard to look after safety, no one is boss. The sense of order emerges as each new group joins the throng. There's no permanent property. The tide sweeps the beach away every day. So the next day's colonists have to start again from scratch. The order will not be exactly the same 2 days running. Beaches are home to oddities. In architecture, there is the pier, fantastical buildings such as the Royal Pavilion in Brighton and Art Deco hotels. There's odd food that you don't get anywhere else, like rock. You're carried around by odd modes of transport, narrow gauge railways, trams, cliff lifts and cable cars, and amused by odd forms of entertainment, Punch and Judy, putting greens and crazy golf. No wonder people feel able to wear odd clothes and expose their bodies in ways they would never do in a city. Beaches are places where people don't have to behave normally. And the article concludes, as Alex Garland puts it in The Beach, there is the beach and the rest of the world. As we reluctantly drag ourselves back to the world at the end of our 2 weeks there, how many of us wish that our offices and companies were governed, at least for some of the time, by the spirit of the beach? Sounds a bit familiar to me, as it were. sounds familiar as I think about Greenbelt as a place as well. Places like Greenbelt and places like beaches are what I would call vital spaces, in the sense that they're places where we are recreated. There are spaces where we get a sense of life. They're spaces where there is shared ownership rather than pooled resources and riches. They're places where boundaries are regularly crossed and norms are challenged. They're places where there's no overt exercise of power or leadership. We feel we're a part of it and we feel we have some sort of share in it. What I'm concerned by is that our churches are not necessarily hallmarked by these same vital signs. Rather than being hallmarked by boundary crossing, they are, in the words of Jung, the psychologist, who was commenting on his own upbringing within a church and his father as a minister within that church. He saw the church as what he said is purified to the point of sterility. They were so pure that actually nothing could happen there. So I'm worried that churches may not be places where boundaries are crossed, as Greenbelt is a place where boundaries are crossed, where people feel able to be more vital. I'm also concerned that they're not hallmarked by gift, by shared ownership, but they're often dominated by worries about success in terms of the market, getting the product right, and they're rather tightly controlled by leaders, rather than, like the beach, like Greenbelt, just places that are congregated by people. Just as an example of that, an unnamed church in an unnamed place, an unnamed person from that church told me a story which they communicated to me as true. I don't know whether it's true or not, but it's amusing and informative anyway. The people in this church were approached by a mission agency and asked to participate in a mission in the local town centre. And the mission agency suggested that because this is quite a wealthy church, they should offer some money for this. And the normal price for doing this mission was £3,000. But because they're quite wealthy, they think that the church ought to offer £6,000 for this. And they were getting churches together in the town centre to join this mission. And the idea behind the mission was that they set up a burger van and they were giving out free burgers in the town centre. And they had patio tables around the burger van where people from the churches were invited to come and start conversations. It didn't actually work, partly because they seriously annoyed those people who were trying to make a living out of selling burgers, you know. And there's actually nothing wrong with that, you know. You're just undermining someone who's trying to get a business going here, and they're giving away burgers. But it struck me that there's something slightly wrong about the whole gift practice, as I was put it, of that mission, in that they were giving something away in order to try and get something back. And what they were giving away, actually, if you're thinking holistically about yourself as a body, about the earth, etc., etc., is giving away burgers actually the best thing for the church to be doing? They were also entering the marketplace and undermining it by giving things away for free, which is a dangerous place for the church to be in because, you know, people have got to be able to go and sell burgers. You know, it's a perfectly legitimate business, and so they annoyed a lot of people. And they had to pay for it as well. So in a sense, the church paid over £6,000 and expected to get a good return on their money, which they didn't. And they really felt they didn't. Now, as I say, I spoke to one person about that, and I don't know necessarily the extent to which they were exaggerating or etc., but even so, as an example, I think it's an important thing that the church has not been hallmarked by sensible ideas about ownership, gift practice, generosity, and so on. However, we're not here to be negative. We're not here to just kind of bang things down and say, oh, isn't everything terrible, and that's what I strongly believe that, as I've just outlined, change is necessary, but not only is change necessary, I believe that change is possible. And we have to believe those two things together. There are some people who don't believe that change is necessary, that everything is fine as it is, that the church and the world is in kind of stasis, it's unmoving, it doesn't need changing, it's just this nice protective little place where people go inside their own comfort zone. They don't think it needs changing, and therefore change is not allowed and not encouraged and so on. And people who doubt that, people in churches who say, look, I really think this needs changing, tend to be ejected from those places. There's also those who don't believe that change is possible. They see that it's necessary, but they don't feel empowered that it's actually possible. And they see structures in place, and people have said to me, you know, I just, you know, the vicar there and, you know, the structures and the whole congregation, it's just impossible to change anything. Well, we need to believe that change is both necessary and possible. There's a political philosopher called Herbert Marcuse, who I'm not well read on. I'm quoting parts of a book of his that I've read. The whole book, I think, is virtually impossible to understand as far as I'm concerned. But the book's called One Dimensional Man, and he talks about, it's a kind of post, you know, Marxist kind of thing. He talks about ways in which society tries to stop things from changing, and he reckons that happens in three ways. Firstly, society says that you're too small to change things. You're just too small, you can't do it. There's no way you could change anything, you're just one person. And that's a message that's given over by the media and those in power, that, look, you're too small, what's the point, you know? 100,000 people marching on the streets in London against a war in Iraq, you know, that you're too small, it doesn't matter. The second lie, as it were, that's perpetuated, that change isn't possible, is to say that change would be personally costly. That, you know, you could change things, but, you know, you're going to have to really change your lifestyle, and that's going to be costly, and you're not going to be able to have your car, and you're going to have to change the way you eat and live and travel and all those things. Your standard of living is going to go down, so don't bother changing things if you are going to suffer personally. And the third one is, if you did change, then you'd be the only one, and everyone's going to laugh at you. And you don't want to do that because, you know, you want to feel part of society, you want to feel included and all those sort of things. So he says that by those three pressures, everyone is kept one-dimensional, that people aren't allowed to express themselves into the second or third dimension. And Thomas Merton, the monk and all-round fantastic person, who I kind of came across Marcuse through, is a brilliant book of his, which isn't that widely available, but seek it out, called Springs of Contemplation. He's got his book New Seeds of Contemplation, but there's a book called Springs of Contemplation, which is transcripts of some lectures he gave on a retreat. Very, very good. But he says this, in a one-dimensional society, everything is reduced to the lowest common denominator, and everybody fits into that. Things are organized so you can fit in easily and happily. The person who fits in painlessly, who does all the approved things, watches all the approved programs, is one-dimensional. When everyone fits into this mold, everything will work smoothly, everyone will make lots of money, the gross national product will go up, everyone will pay their taxes, blacks will keep their mouths shut and will win all our wars. That's quite a challenging thing that he's saying there. That this is what society is telling us we need to do. I don't think it takes too much imagination to kind of move over from that and think perhaps there's an element in which we're living often in one-dimensional churches. In that people say nothing needs changing, no critique is necessary, so doubters must leave. Nothing can be changed, so no critique is possible, and doubters die banging their heads against a wall. And if I could paraphrase Merton from that perspective, when everyone fits into this mould, everything will work smoothly. Everyone will still make lots of money, alpha attendance will go up, everyone will pay their tithes, queers will keep their mouths shut, and we'll still win all our wars. As Christians, we need to believe that change is both necessary and possible. But what I want to do is to think about how that change might occur. What I've tried to do in the book that I've written is to outline ways in which things can change. And I want to propose that if we want to see genuine transformation, by which I mean real change on the inside and real holistic change, then we're better taking the model of beach life, as I outlined at the beginning, than to try and attempt some top-down, hard-line mode of reprogramming ourselves and our churches and our organisations. Okay? And in the book, for the sake of argument, whatever, I've kind of distinguished those into two modes of change, one which I call revolution and the other I call evolution. And I'm proposing that too often we've tried to change things by revolution, but actually we need to get into an evolutionary mode of changing things. Revolution, as I outline it, is hallmarked by power, by strong leadership, by force, things being top-down, violent, a system where knowledge is power and knowledge is controlled very tightly. Just to give you an example of a kind of ideological perspective on that, Microsoft is a company which controls its intellectual property very, very tightly. Its approach to its property is to say there's only a very small number of people who are allowed to know the code of the programs we release. The problem with that is when you get a virus which attacks it, when people identify a loophole, it's only those selected high priests of Microsoft, as it were, who are the ones who have the power to be able to write the patch to kind of sort the virus out, which means it takes quite a lot of time, but it also means it leaves them very exposed to that kind of attack. The other end of the spectrum, you have these open source, open kind of knowledge program systems, whereby the code is available for everybody to look at. And what happens then is that because everyone can look at it, everyone can identify any loopholes, and then everyone is available to kind of help out with the job of patching it up and making it good, because everyone will benefit from that. So there's a kind of bottom-up approach to programming and a top-down approach to programming, which kind of mirrors this idea of revolution as a top-down, centralized knowledge approach or a bottom-up, distributed knowledge approach. And I want to talk about that more in a minute. The revolutionary mode of change is the kind of thing we see typified with things like regime change in Iraq, where we're going to go in, shock and awe, we're going to do this incredibly quickly, we're going to just batter these people out, and we're going to give you democracy even if you didn't damn well vote for it. The revolutionary mode of thinking is by that aspect, it's a social mode. It's a way of organizing society as well as just a way of trying to effect change. But what I'm trying to argue is that revolutionary mode of change, which is what you've seen in wars and political systems for hundreds and hundreds of years, is not effecting change properly. It's changing little but the flag. It's not really directly impacting people's lives on the ground. And it's only through the kind of hearts and minds, slow work with people in the local communities that's actually going to help to rebuild countries and to really affect genuine transformation. And suddenly in the vacuum after a war like you saw in Iraq, people suddenly realized, heck, you know, we really should have done this perhaps a different way. And that's where you're trying to then pick up the pieces. Yeah.
Context of the revolution.
Mm-hmm.
Prior to it happening, there is people in a certain context, aren't they?
Yeah.
For revolution to happen, they have to come from one context to another.
Right. I think what you're asking is how do you actually start to build an evolutionary mode of change? What I try and say in the book is, yes, here's revolution, here's evolution, or evolutionary mode of change. What actually needs to happen is somewhere in the kind of strange place in the middle, because you can't have anarchy. You can't just say, right, everybody just go and organize yourselves. That's not going to work. And in fact, systems that do organize themselves on bottom-up principles, which I don't want to kind of crush the question, but I will talk about in a minute, actually do so with a mild form of regulation and leadership anyway. So this is not anarchic no leadership, but it's a leadership that is trying to release people rather than say, this is what you're going to do. We can perhaps come back to that at the end. I do want to have some time for questioning and discussion at the end, so please do hold on to that. So at the other end of the spectrum, you've got this evolutionary mode of change or an evolutionary way of organising things, which I would want to see is hallmarked by distributed power. It's kind of open source. It's not the truth resides in me, therefore I'm going to stand up and preach and you've got to listen to me, and what I say is truth and my reading of scripture is truth. But it's truth as a discussion, as a debate amongst a community, and it's a community that's evolving towards its truth together rather than being told by one person this what's true. It's bottom-up, it's networked, where a revolutionary mindset sees simplistic solutions and simplistic problems. An evolutionary mindset sees the world as an interconnected, interrelated, complex place. Complex solutions, complex to complex problems. And this is the sense in which I want to use the word complex in the title, The Complex Christ. I'm not saying it as anti-simplicity. There is excellent teaching and excellent things to say about the simple life and simplicity and Christ's life of simplicity. That's not the sense in which I'm using it. I'm using the word complexity in the way that there is a science of complexity which is trying to discuss and work out how systems in the world do try and organise themselves from the bottom up. Just in terms of this article about the beach, they talk about that here. So scientists have a fancy name for this, the beach that organises itself. They call it complexity and emergence. An overall order emerges from a system with many players in which no one person is in charge and every player is adjusting to local conditions. So that's the sense in which I want to think about complexity. Not as something that's complicated, but it is, but something that's interrelated, it's bottom-up, it's networked. A couple of examples of that from different situations. Firstly, let's check time. Firstly, you've got things like your brain. Your brain is not a top-down revolutionary system. It's not got one supercell that tells all the other cells what to do. It's completely networked. Everything is distributed. Your brain works on bottom-up distributed systems. Cities are places that are mildly regulated. They're not anarchic places. You have to have some mild regulation, but basically they're organised on those networked bottom-up principles as well. You don't have someone sitting in London trying to organise how much meat needs to be imported into London the next day or we're all going to starve. There's no one doing that job. That's something that happens and evolves by people interrelating and you know, the market actually working and bringing those things to bear and bringing that things... Right, just one other example of that. There's a computer programmer called Danny Hillis, who's famous in those circles, who tried to apply his brain to one of these kind of key problems that computer programmers like to do, which is number sorting. Here's 100 random numbers. How long does it take you to sort them into order? And, of course, it's a simple problem to do it in 99 steps because you just take each number and you just arrange them in order. But there are quicker ways of doing that. And if you can work out quicker ways of doing logic problems like that, then it helps the speed of programming in general. So it's a very good way of testing how efficient your programming is. Anyway, rather than writing a program from the top down, looking at it logically, rationally from the top and saying, yeah, this is what I'm going to write, instead, he made a computer make up little bits of programming code. And then he just tested them to see if they were any good at all at sorting numbers. And if they were any good at all, in almost a kind of Darwinist system, he let them survive to the next generation, and then he kind of mated them with each other, so kind of, you know, changed bits of code from one to the other. And he repeated this process, you know, and then saw if they were any good at number sorting again, repeated this process on a computer, you know, kind of tens of thousands of generations. And he ended up getting a number sorting program that was quicker than anyone else had ever got by organizing it from the top down. Now, the interesting thing is, when he looked at the program that he'd come up with, or that the computer had come up with, from this bottom-up sort of evolutionary system, he didn't understand how it worked. He had absolutely no idea what it was doing. Now, what I want to say on that is that we must be very, very careful when we're thinking about trying to establish or trying to bring a new church to emerge, and that we are not, or we cannot yet say what it is going to be, nor are we going to be able to rationally understand every single part of it. There is going to be something of the cloud of unknowing, the dark night of the soul about it. There's going to be something unknown and not rational. We cannot simply say, this is what it's going to be like. Otherwise, we'd all be trying to do it. And if you get people saying, this is what it's going to be like, don't listen to them, because you can guarantee they're just interested in holding on to power and reorganizing things and being in charge themselves. Now, I'm not here to say this is what it's going to be like. Well, all I want to do is to say, here are some initial conditions that are interesting to set some of these systems going, and then walk away, and I want everyone else to try and work out what the heck that means in their local situation. So I'm not going to tell you what I think the church should look like, but I'm going to tell you some characteristics of what it might be characterized by. But that's not to say what it's going to necessarily be in locally. So, first of all, a church based on these kind of evolutionary emergent principles, it's going to be an open system kind of church. It's going to be something, as one writer has put it, open to its environment, sensing it, responding to it, and shaping it. Biological systems are not closed. If you look at... A very good example to talk about in the book is a mould which exists in a wood. And this slime mould, it's very difficult to work out where the slime mould begins and the rest of the environment it's existing in starts. And in fact, that boundary is incredibly blurred because it keeps changing. Sometimes it exists as one big blob together and you'll see it on a piece of log, a kind of yellow slime. And you come back 2 days later and it's moved. You know, where's it gone? It hasn't kind of walked off. What's happened is that because the conditions are right, it's split up into its individual little constituent cells, and they're all kind of working and feeding individually. And then when conditions change, they just come back together and go on as a unit together. Now, that's something that's sensing its environment, is in touch with the environment that's around it. And the church has to be doing that. It's not an independent community. We cannot be surviving kind of with oxygen masks on. We need to be breathing and living the same air, being interdependent with the world that we are living in. We've got to be adaptable to local situations, not fixed on one model. Alpha may work very well in Kensington. I don't want to knock it at all, but that doesn't mean that it's going to work in Kenya without some local adaptation and real local thought and knowledge. There is no answer to the question, why do tigers have stripes and leopards have spots? Unless you know the local conditions within which those different animals evolved. Okay? You cannot simply say, well, let's just chuck a tiger in Battersea Park. You know, sure, it'll be fine. It seems to work really well over in the Indian subcontinent. You cannot be doing just dropping models from one place to another. And we need to also learn to be really good at feedback. In other words, listening to what people are saying, feeding that back in, and using that to help change things again, and then changing things, listening to feedback, and going through that feedback cycle. I want to move on quite quickly. As I've already mentioned, these vital places that I want church to be need to be places where gifts are exchanged. Give you a very quick example. The difference between going to a restaurant, paying for your food, leaving without going up to the chef and saying, oh, that was fantastic, you must come to my house for dinner, I really want to, you know, to have you round, to inviting someone round for dinner, where not only would it be outrageously rude to then for them to offer to pay for the meal you've just given them, but there's a sense in which you invite someone round for dinner and give them that gift of a meal, there's a sort of relationship potential which is left in that situation, which there isn't when you do the money exchange. Because you've exchanged money at the restaurant or at Sainsbury's, you don't need to have that relationship potential. You've balanced the scales. When you give someone a gift of a meal or something else, the scales are unbalanced. And it's just for the church to stand back and say, well, you know, in its own good time, that gift may come round and be reciprocated. But churches need to be centres of gift exchange. Existing in communities which are dominated by market exchange, we need to be places that are centres of gift exchange, and therefore where relationships will be encouraged. We also, like the beach, need to be places where the abnormal is normal, places where boundaries are crossed. There's a big theme of dirt going on within the book and within the things that we've done with Vox, and I believe in the Gospels. If you imagine, I mean, we're at Greenbelt, we can talk about dirt. If you take some of the dirt from the field and you put that onto your dinner plate, that is filthy. That the dirt is the soil on the plate. If you take the Coke can and drop it in the field, it's the Coke can that's become dirt. The field is clean. It's full of soil, quite perfectly clean. But you drop litter in it, the litter is the dirt. However, you pick that up and you look at the Coke can, you say the Coke can's dirty because the dirt's on the Coke can. So dirt is not a fixed thing. Dirt is where matter is in the wrong place. Things that are in the wrong place are dirty. And there's, you know, hilarious examples of early settlers and colonialists going to these islands and saying, you know, you're disgusting things. You know, you go and crap in the on the beach. And the islanders are saying, well, look at you lot. You know, you build houses and you crap in your house. I mean, so it's all relative. Matter is out of... dirt is matter out of place. But where we draw our dirt boundaries, that's how we decide. That's how we configure society. Where the right place to do a crap is. Who's in, who's out. Who's clean, who's dirty. These are the ways that society is built up. And it's, you know, we've just had a baby recently, and, you know, you see people, one of the first things they teach their children, no, that's dirty. You know, these are boundaries that we have to set up in order to make society work. But the church needs to be a place where those boundaries are reconfigured, where who's in and who's out is a completely different ballgame to what society says. They should be places where people can do their dirt work, where their boundaries are crossed, and where we're prepared to cross boundaries to meet people. I asked Rowan Williams a question about it yesterday, and if anyone was there, I'm sorry, I didn't ask for the book to be plugged. Martin Rowe asked me to ask the question, but anyway. I've been reflecting on how we talk about Jesus going in and cleaning the temple, and I actually think that's wrong. Jesus didn't go in to clean the temple. Jesus went to the outer courts of the temple and swept that clean in order that the dirty might have free access to the temple. Christ was not trying to restrict the dirty coming in. He was saying, you're restricting the dirty from coming in by forcing them to buy, you know, all this kind of stuff. You've got to buy the pure stuff, and you've got to buy the currency to buy the pure stuff, and you're stopping the dirty coming into the temple to find cleansing. And I think we're in danger of doing that as well. We need to be happy for the dirt to come in, because the church has got to be the place where dirt work occurs. So the question then is, why did I call the book The Complex Christ, not just The Complex Church? If this is just some interesting way that we might kind of begin to reconfigure the church, and I'm sorry if I've glossed over it quite quickly, but we haven't got a lot of time and I want to have some discussion. If this is just about reorganising church in a different kind of mode, why not just call it The Complex Church? You know, this could just be some new management style or whatever. What I firmly believe is that in the incarnation and ministry and passion and ascension and Pentecost, we see God actually putting into place this evolutionary bottom-up complex networked system. This is not something that we're just inventing. This is something that God dreamt up years ago, and this is what we should be modelling. We need to be modelling what this is doing. Christ did not come to the temple to become a high priest in a hierarchical, top-down system. Christ arrived as with only enough energy for that sperm to break the wall of that egg, and then just nestled inside Mary's womb and grew and grew and began to evolve, and was then born into a world, that Christ needed. Christ needed sustenance from Mary. Christ would have died without that sustenance from the world. And similarly, the church has to be dependent on the community that it's hosted by, not independent, saying, oh, you know, we're fine without us. We need to be feeding on that milk. The church also needs to still become these wombs of the divine. We need to be impregnated ourselves and bring newness to birth in this way that Christ did in the incarnation. Christ had time to grow and mature It's very interesting hearing Rowan Williams say yesterday about how he dislikes email and this kind of instant response culture. Christ took his time, you know, they think maybe about 30 years old before he actually started his public ministry. It's a long time just to grow up, to think, to really engage and to be in the world. Christ also in his ministry had a very interesting engagement with the city, which is why I've wanted this to be about the urban church, because I have a passion for the fact that I don't think we should just be getting up and leaving our cities when we're rich enough to move out to the suburbs and afford decent schools. I think that is a seriously wrong thing, and I come back in 5 years, and if I've moved out, then someone shoot me. The city in Scripture starts as a statement of rejection of God. Cain goes off and builds a city, having killed his brother, and it's like Cain made three cuts. He cut himself off from God. He spilt his brother's blood on the ground, which poisoned the earth and also poisoned his relationships with his family. And the city is almost a statement of those rejections. Rejecting God, rejecting the environment, and rejecting those around us. We're independent, we're surrounded, paved over the earth, and we're rejecting God. But if you go, flip to the other end of the book, in Revelation you see the city as a place where God and humanity are interdependent. We are co-creators with God in the city. All this stuff around us, the concrete, the glass, the plastics, these materials, they are all God's stuff that God created in the earth that we have then taken and reconfigured with our hands to make beautiful, wonderful structures that allow us to live together. Now, in that way, the city becomes an extraordinary place of urban meditation and reflection, a place where you can reflect on the fact that this is God's stuff. It's the same stuff that's out there in the mountains and the oceans, but the stuff in the mountains and the oceans is great. It's just God on God's own. There's nothing, our fingerprints aren't on it. And that's fine for meditation sometimes, but when to reflect on the city, where places that we have reconfigured, that then speaks to us about a complicated God who's interacting with us and we're interacting with God. So the church needs to be involved, and God got involved in the city as an interdependent place. Christ also refused to participate in the marketing of religion. In the desert, in the temptations, you see Christ being tempted to try and win people to devotion through bread. Here's some bread. Now, I've given you some bread. It's a bit like the burgers. Here's some bread. Now listen to me. And resisted that temptation fully. He also resisted the temptation to, really I see it as the kind of celebrity temptation. Watch me jump from the temple and do this amazing trick. Now listen to me. Now what... The reason Christ had to resist that was, that's a great trick, Christ. Now do something else and jump from a higher place, do something even more incredible. I've seen one healing, I want to see 20 more now. You've got to keep up the tricks and Fantastica and keep up the celebrity and this huge kind of candy floss image. Christ resisted that. He went the way of the gift. And the cross we see as this radical gift. It cannot be bought or sold. And through it, the scales are not balanced. There is nothing we can give in return. And Christ fully entered into that mode of gift-giving. And similarly, in the same way, we need to see our worship as a gift. We don't go to church in order to get. We should be going in order to give. I'm fed up of this attitude of, I didn't really get much out of that service and didn't really like those songs. And what we're really saying is, the worship leader didn't play the songs that we particularly like when we say we didn't have a great time of worship. What did we go along to give? What gift did we bring along? And if we get anything in return, that's just incredible. That's a bonus. But we need to try and go and give. I've already mentioned about Christ and the temple and ideas of dirt there. But all the way through the Gospels, Christ dealt with dirt boundaries. Touching lepers, speaking to women, speaking to Samaritans, crossing boundaries, going to people, totally unafraid that he was going to be infected himself. And this was the Pharisees' worry that if they touch lepers, they become impure. As Christ says, I am pure. It doesn't matter. I can go to these people. I can go to those with AIDS, you know, minister to the dead, all these kind of things. And you can fully cross those dirt boundaries. Interestingly enough, what that's connected with then, when you're challenging society's ideas of who's in and who's out, you're challenging the mechanisms of forgiveness. And that's what really pissed people off. If Christ can say, you're forgiven, then a whole lot of people are out of a job. And that's very, very threatening to people. But if you... So Christ was stepping over dirt boundaries and thereby challenging the very way that that society was constructed and saying it's got to be reconfigured in a different way. Which is, again, interesting that Rowan Williams talking about the penal system, that that's an encouraging thing that the church is engaging with. Christ welcomes the dirty. There's also another element to dirt which I want to touch on. There are lots of stories in lots of different traditions and folklore about trickster figures. Trickster figures are those kind of interesting figures who live on the boundary, who are very, very difficult to pin down. And there's one in Alaskan folklore about this this god called Raven, and a trickster figure who goes to Raven, and Raven's holding on to all the water. This is up in the kind of Arctic area. Raven's holding on to all the water and is stopping anyone else getting any water. And this trickster figure goes to Raven, tries to get him to give water, won't give any water. Eventually, Raven falls asleep. And the trickster figure gets some dog dirt and smears it all over Raven's bum, wakes him up and says, look, you've crapped yourself. And Raven, being so shocked, flies off to try and clean himself. And in doing so, brings water out from the place where he's keeping it, and some drips from his beak. And the drops that come from his beak go down to the earth below and create all the lakes and rivers. Now, that's a classic trickster story in that the trickster appears to dirty God, but in dirtying God brings heaven and earth closer, and a gift is brought from heaven, the gift of water is brought from heaven. Now, we can kind of see Christ functioning in that trickster way. What could be more dirty? And in that definition, what could be more out of place than this Christ being cursed by being hung on a tree? What could be more out of place than God whipped, stripped, crown of thorns, all of that? And yet, in that dirtying of God, this gift from heaven is brought to us, and heaven and earth are brought closer. So we see Christ functioning in a classic way throughout literature as this trickster figure. And the interesting thing is that God is, you know, kind of simultaneously and mysteriously working as the God being debased and the trickster doing the debasing. The trouble is that we don't like playing with dirt, and we've ended up purifying the church, as I talked earlier, to the point of sterility. And we do that at our peril. Trying to expel dirt from the church will only end up with it dying. Nothing can live in those places. So this is not just a bit of management speak about the church becoming bottom-up, because that's a good way to organise things. I think this is the way ahead, because this is the way that Christ has modelled. This is, in the incarnation and the passion, we see Christ modelling this way, this bottom-up, emergent, complex, gift-giving, generous, dirty God, doing something unique, and we as the body of Christ need to be modelling that. It's threatening to the powerful, it's threatening to those who want to stay in charge, the rich and the influential. But the battle is on throughout our lives to try and push for that evolutionary mode of change rather than the revolutionary. And this is a battle that I believe Christ fought, both in the temptations, but in real focus, I think it comes to the head, to a head in the passion. And we see the disciples gathered in a city. We read earlier on that all of the disciples had tried to make Jesus king. They'd all tried to make him king. They'd all tried to make him this big political top-down leader. They failed. Judas is getting very, very vexed because he's not doing what Judas expected him to do. Judas is an interesting character. It appears that Judas was the only one who wasn't a kind of country boy. He was one of the disciples from the city, probably saw himself a bit more savvy, a bit more streetwise, a bit more politically aware and so on. And he says, you know, someone's got to act here. Jesus is losing it. He's going to lose his opportunity. Someone's got to precipitate a revolution. So he goes to the priests and says, look, I can get you Jesus. And they say, and if you, you know, you read the gospel passages about this, they say, great, but whatever you do, don't betray him during the festival. Don't betray him during this Passover festival that's coming up. And Judas is like, and they say, don't betray him because the people will riot. And Judas is like, fantastic, what a great idea. I'll betray him during the festival because then we'll precipitate this riot and this revolution. They gather at the Last Supper. Bread is broken and wine is shared. And I wonder, I don't know, I wonder if perhaps Judas is one of the few people who actually understood what Christ was doing. And it was so threatening, this act of breaking Christ's body, that if you believe what that was meaning, then that symbolic act of spreading out and devolving Christ from this centralized body into a dispersed, invisible network that people take in, if that was to be believed, that was very threatening, because that threatens the temple system, it threatens the whole way that Jewish society is constructed. And where would his place be in the political revolution if Jesus was not planning on being this political revolutionary? So he's got to stop him. It's as if Judas sees Jesus as a nuclear bomb that he's got to make safe. He's got to control it, use it for himself, and make it safe. So he leaves the gifts of bread and wine and slips out, and as we're told, it's night. He goes and betrays him in Gethsemane. He comes up to Christ and kisses him. And I wonder if Judas thought Jesus is going to be pleased because I'm giving him this opportunity. So he comes to Jesus, kisses him. Aren't you pleased? Look what I'm doing, you know. Here we go, we can start a revolution. And things go pretty well. A fight breaks out, all the disciples, swords are drawn, they start fighting, there's a bit of a riot going on. Great. And then Jesus says, stop. And in that moment, they flee. All of them flee. And Judas realizes he's done the wrong thing. It hasn't worked. And he's basically handed him over to be killed. Jesus goes to be crucified, the curtain in the temple is torn, and Christ, God, is let out of the box. It's as if the bomb has gone off, the file is broken and the virus escapes, and in the coming of the Spirit, you see this bunch of fishermen, the professional religious, not even involved, are just given this holy freedom to be this networked, complex body of Christ. And in the taking of communion, we take in, we share that bread and wine, we break it up, make it decentralized, and then take it out of there. And it can no longer be controlled. It can no longer be killed. That's the complexity of Christ that I think we need to be heading for. The church, and we always try to resist it, but we are being Judas every time we try to box God up and co-opt God into our own agenda. We are being Judas when we try to precipitate revolutions, when we say you can't read the Bible unless it's in Latin, when we say you have to listen to this sort of music in church, and so on and so forth. Can I just finish with a poem? Have I got time for that? Yeah? Okay. This is a poem by R.S. Thomas, which is called Emerging. Not as in the old days I pray, God. My life is not what it was. Yours too accepts the presence of the machine. Once I would have asked healing. I go now to be doctored, to drink sinlessly of the blood of my brother, to lend my flesh as manuscript of the great poem of the scalpel. I would have knelt long, wrestling with you, wearing you down. Hear my prayer, Lord, hear my prayer. As though you were deaf, myriads of mortals have kept up their shrill cry, explaining your silence by their unfitness. It begins to appear that this is not what prayer is about. It's the annihilation of difference, the consciousness of myself in you, of you in me, the emerging from the adolescence of nature into the adult geometry of the mind. I begin to recognize you anew, God of form and number. There are questions we are the solution to, others whose echoes we must expand to contain. Circular as our way is, it leads not back to that snake-haunted garden, but onward to the tall city of glass that is the laboratory of the spirit. I'll stop talking there and try and answer any questions or... Yes. Yeah. Can I start with the liberation theology? I'm not an expert. There are many people who are, and if anyone does have expertise in that area and would like to reflect on that, I'd love them to do that. In terms of the first part of the question, it's going to take a long time. Yes, that's the church in the season of Advent, and it is absolutely vital that we do that waiting. We are very, very impatient for change. But our impatience tends to lead us down lines, false avenues, false starts. We absolutely must wait. And I talk about this in the book about we need to go through a period of Advent. Just as in the desert, you know, I mean, throughout history, people have had to wait. And I think we need to do that waiting. Otherwise, we're going to end up with just... Kendrick in different clothes again, you know, and I'm just being silly there, but we're not going to get genuine transformation. We're just going to paper over the cracks again and paper over the cracks again. We have to do something new, but that will require the old to die, and we must wait for that. Yeah. Mm.
And I think linked to the last question, it's very interesting what you're saying, and I'm very drawn to it. But it's a lot about the form that we take. And surely that's got to be linked to its function. And what is the church's function in an unjust world? What should we be moving towards evolutionary wise?
Absolutely. I hate to be internal, but what I'm trying to say is that we need to get our internal initial conditions right in order that something can begin to evolve. So I'm thinking internally about those things. In terms of the work that the church needs to do engaging externally, of course, we must carry on with that fight for justice and so on. I mean, in terms of Martin Luther King, absolutely, he was a fantastic guy, but really, he was almost precipitated his work by a single woman refusing to give up her seat on a bus. Now, that's bottom up. That's, you know, he could say all he liked, but the power of the movement was individual people on the ground being prepared to do the small things. He was kind of the voice to the powers that be and the inspiration. And I don't want to kind of completely polarize. You need leadership, but we don't want dictation. We don't want people being dictators. We don't need, you know, it's just the vicar who does everything. They're the ones who stand up. They're the ones who tell the truth. They're the ones who are on the preaching rota. They're the ones who do everything. We need to get away from this kind of professional ministry situation where, you know, again, in terms of gift practice, we pay them their salary, so we want our money's worth. It's not good enough. It's just not good enough to do that. Yeah, at the back.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, what I'm trying to say, we need to start a process. This is not like, right, we're all now going to change and do this and be finished. We need to get into a mindset where we begin an evolutionary process, and that means we continue evolving because local situations are going to change. Just as the world adapts and change, we need to be getting a mindset where we can continue to respond and change. Not respond and change once and reach there and that's it, but carry on the journey. Because this is all about, the process rather than the product. It's got to be about an ongoing system of change rather than just, here we are, now we've made it, aren't we great now? But continuing to evolve all the time. There's a theory in Japanese kind of management called Kaizen, which a lot of big companies run on, whereby anybody is allowed to affect any tiny change as long as it improves their work and their productivity. And by everybody on the ground doing tiny changes, companies are turned around in huge ways. And that's a process that has to keep on going and going and going. Yeah.
So I wonder whether it's a case of holding some of these things in tension and saying that sometimes we should be looking more towards the polarity of revolutionary change and sometimes more evolutionary model. And maybe the fact that you and a few other people like Professor are beginning to say things about evolution again means that maybe it's time to start looking at this again, having had sort of 30 or 40 years of sort of Jesus the revolutionary.
Yeah, I would completely agree with that. Again, yeah. What I would say is that I'm worried by this idea of change by program, that we can buy into change, that I can go and buy this off the shelf. Here's the new church. Right, we're all buying into it. And there are models of things like that around. You know, it's very, very tempting to say, right, we're going to buy into this model and we're all going to change and do that. That's just not good enough because it's got to be local and adaptable and it's got to be sensing to its own unique environment. So, yes, I would agree that... I've probably chosen the wrong words, to be honest, but, you know, I did it for semantic reason and that was it. But what I'm trying to say is that through an evolutionary change, I'm meaning that we need to be in touch with our local environment. We need to be doing things from the bottom up. We need to be engaging with ideas of generosity and gift and dirt and thinking about things in an interrelated way rather than a simplistic way. And perhaps, you know, just for the sake of ease, I used those two words. Yeah, have we run out of time? Thank you ever so much for coming. As I say... the discussion continues online. If you've just been here or you've read the book, then thecomplexchrist.com. I would love to see this go further than just the book by me, but into a kind of conjunctive discussion. Thank you.